Today's lecture is on Chesapeake Society's to 1660. Right, so yeah, it's really about this, the evolution, the development of Chesapeake Society from this brutal, chaotic, horrible society where, you know, you were lucky to live to the age of 40. That was certainly not thriving in the 1620s when we last were there. To a much more developed, permanent, secure, settled one, where society is much more secure and developed. It's also about the geographic spread of settlement. It's not just about the fact that population rises. Population also spreads out, partly because as a result of the wars that they had with the Powhatan, which I talked about last week, you're pushing the Indians away from the coast and you are moving into those lands. That's part of the process, but also you've got increasing numbers of people who are moving into those lands and becoming more sort of anglicised, I guess. They're becoming more like plantations, they're planting crops, they're interacting with Jamestown, etc. And so this lecture focuses on a very short period of time, just over 35 years, where Virginia moves from being a, you know, will it last, won't it last, is it all going to go pear-shaped society to a, oh, of course, Virginia, that's that, you know, really thriving, bustling colony on the shores of the Chesapeake. And it happens in a very short period of time, basically one generation. And that's what I'm going to talk about. This map shows you the geographic spread of Jamestown. It's geographic spread of Virginia and settlement in the Chesapeake, away from Jamestown, which is the initial settlement in 1607, and specifically that map shows you the geographic relationship between Roanoke Island, which is where the first settlement was in the 1580s, Jamestown, and the new settlement of Maryland, which I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about now. Maryland is first mooted in the 1630s. The charter is granted to a man called George Calvert, otherwise known as Lord Baltimore. Now, I wonder where they got the name Baltimore from for their city. He manages eventually to put together some settlers to go to Baltimore, to go to Maryland in 1634. And Maryland is what is known as a proprietary colony. It's very different from Virginia. Virginia, remember, started out as the Virginia Company, as did Massachusetts, as a company, organised government. And Virginia in 1624 becomes a royal colony, so its officials are appointed by the king. Well, Maryland is effectively its own little princely state for Lord Baltimore. And he acts like the king in Maryland. He has complete control over almost every aspect of life there. And the proprietary colony is the model that will be followed increasingly in the 17th century. Colonies such as the Carolinas, Pennsylvania, the Jerseys, they're all proprietary colonies. Even New York becomes a proprietary colony. And it encourages, you know, great men in England to have their own slice of America and to bear all the expense and hardship of trying to settle it, trying to frame laws, etc., and govern it, all those sorts of things. The crown is basically passing the buck in the 17th century. It later has to resume that burden in the 18th century, but that's a different story. The first settlers of 1634 decide to settle in a place called St. Mary's City, which until relatively recently was one of these lost cities that nobody knew quite where it had been. But then recently it was discovered through archaeological research and has started to be excavated. And it's a far healthier location for a settlement than, for example, Jamestown. It's not, for instance, in the middle of a malarial swamp. So that's a big tick next to St. Mary's City. And so certainly there is quite a lot of evidence that the settlers who went to Maryland had learned something from the settlers who went to Jamestown. For instance, they knew that they could grow tobacco in Virginia. They didn't have to spend 10 years thinking about what crop they're going to grow. They know the tobacco will grow in the climate of Maryland. He also avoids, Lord Baltimore avoids, any kind of crisis of authority by sending his own brother to be governor of Maryland. So, you remember how early Virginia, they had lots of crisis of authority, who was going to rule, they keep on sending out new governors from England, you know, that's always a big problem. Whereas in America, that's, in Maryland, that's not an issue. And interestingly, Maryland is conceived as a Catholic colony. Calvert himself is a Catholic. He tries to create this Catholic colony, which is sort of a place where Catholics can be Catholic without being persecuted. Remember that Catholics are persecuted in England. Lord Baltimore tries to create a colony which is run by Catholics, so that all appointed officials in Maryland are Catholic. But this quickly proves to be very unpopular and practically unworkable, because although Maryland is created as a Catholic colony, and it's created as Maryland for Lord Baltimore, it's basically carved out of territory that had originally been part of Virginia and had been settled increasingly in the 1620s and 30s by people who went to live in Virginia, and then suddenly they find themselves through a redrawing of maps and boundaries, but they're in Maryland, and they're thinking, well, okay, I don't mind being in Maryland, who cares? But then they find out that actually being in Maryland involves being in a Catholic colony, and being a Catholic, and they'd gone to be Protestants, and so they have an issue with that. And eventually, the solution is a Toleration Act, passed in 1649, granting religious toleration to all types of worshippers in Maryland. And it's sort of a model for Toleration Acts in America, something that becomes very popular in the course of the rest of the colonial era, is this haven of religious toleration. That's what America becomes famous for, is its religious toleration. There's an artist's rendition of St. Mary's City, and not that dissimilar in some respects to Jamestown. It's square rather than being triangular, but it's still a fort, it's palisaded. It's got redoubts where you have gun emplacements, so it's still got defence, you know, as one of its key prerequisites. There is Lord Baltimore, you see, and he's such his own little prince in that he even mints his own coins with his own head on it. So, I mean, not many people actually get to do that. And here is the Toleration Act of 1649. I won't expect you to read the original because it's in that horrible early English script. But basically, it's an anti-slander law. It's talking about people will be punished if they talk in a reproachful manner by calling somebody a heretic, schismatic, idolater, Puritan, independent Presbyterian, antinomian, Barrowist, Roundhead, Separatist, Popish priest, Jesuit, Jesuitic papist, Lutheran, Calvinist, Anabaptist, Brownist. So it's being as comprehensive as it can be, trying to find different names that you've got. I'm sure it doesn't cover absolutely every one of them. But if you call somebody one of these names in a reproachful way, like saying, get out of here, you Puritan, you know, or something like that, then that's a finable offence for the sort of 10 shillings. And if you can't pay your 10 shillings, you're going to be publicly whipped and imprisoned without bail until they shall satisfy the party so offended or grieved by such reproachful language. So it's a fairly strict law, and it basically says, you know, shut up about religion, we don't talk about it anymore, and you certainly don't insult other people's religion. Everyone's entitled to their own beliefs, and let's just keep it at that. Which is actually quite a sensible law, really, and it sort of ends up being what happens nowadays, unless you're in Iran or something like that. Most of the rest of the lecture isn't really about Maryland, and it's more about the Chesapeake, more about Virginia. But you've always got to remember that Maryland is part of the Chesapeake, and so although quite a lot of what I'm going to say is about Virginia, it doesn't always pertain only to Virginia. Sometimes it also pertains to Maryland. I did talk about the demographics of early Virginia before, and you've got to remember that Virginia's population is this sort of weird aberration, because it's a vast majority of young people and a vast majority of males, and there are very few women, and there are very few elderly people, or even children, to be honest. I mean, we've got a population that is mainly male and aged between 18 and 25, sort of thing. Virginia Company does start to import women deliberately and sell them to colonists from 1618 onwards. And you'd sell women for up to £50 worth of tobacco. And planters who were buying these women would be... The tobacco redeems their transport costs, but then they earn the rights to keep these women as workers for 7 years, so they're like indentured servants, but also they are sort of buying sexual access to these women as well. But the demographic is very slow to change. The importation of these women does not suddenly change Virginia from being a male colony to being a mixed colony. Even in 1660, so at the end of this lecture period, 4 out of 5 people are male. So it's a very slow thing to change. It does change a bit more quickly after 1660, but up until 1660, you've still got a very much heavily majority male population. But this very sort of youthful colony does change slightly because you begin to get the start of the appearance of families. And families do tend to rein in that youthful, drunken exuberance which young males are, which is their natural tendency, let's say. And there's certainly some element that planters begin to think about their posterity. They begin to think about their inheritance for their children a bit more, and that makes them change their behaviour slightly. But although you get the start of the appearance of families, you haven't got demographic stability in Virginia, not merely because you haven't got very many women, but because death rates remain ridiculously high. And it's worth spending a little bit of time explaining a little bit more about that. Up to a third of all settlers in Virginia die every year. So that statistic alone should tell you you need a very high rate of immigration in order to keep the population topped up. A third of children are orphaned by 18, and two-thirds lost at least one parent. So only a third of children are reaching 18 with two parents who are alive. And so the typical nuclear family you might get here, parents and children, it's almost unknown in Virginia. What you get is a lot of extended families of stepmothers, stepsisters, half-brothers, half-sisters, that sort of thing is very, very common. And it's quite common for you to end up in a household where you're not biologically related to anybody. And yet everyone's your new mother's, wife's, husband's, whatever. It's a really, really complicated, relationship, and you just happen to be in that household with sort of an adult. What do people die of? They are dying of malaria. Jamestown, remember, is in a swamp where there's lots of mosquitoes, and those mosquitoes carry malaria. And malaria doesn't necessarily kill you, but it does make you much more susceptible to other diseases, such as dysentery, which the settlers very graphically described as the bloody flux. It's fairly accurate, I would think. And dysentery is exacerbated by the lack of fresh water in Jamestown, and the fact that you get salt water poisoning from the wells. The James River at that point is sort of a mix of salt and fresh water, and that doesn't help sometimes. The water is polluted. Of course, as I talked about last week, 1622, a quarter of the population are killed by Indians. So the Indians are a major impact on the population over a period of time. But there's also, very significantly, a give-up-itis, a sense that when all... this is a phrase coined by Karen Kupperman in an article called Apathy and Early Death in Jamestown. And Karen Kupperman is arguing here that the psychological effect of a situation when you're completely without hope, beyond redemption, is that it makes you physically ill. Is that once hope has gone, and then what you get is a decline of your general health, which makes you more susceptible to things like malaria, dysentery, etc. So the psychological impact of disease, of early death. When, remember, if you are surviving all these other things, what you're seeing is you're sitting in a society where 30% of the people die every year, which is potentially a very terrifying experience. Certainly makes you a lot more, very aware of your own mortality, I would think. So you can't discount the psychological effects. I've got here a letter, extract of a letter from a man called Richard Threeform, who in 1623 is writing to his parents. He's in Virginia as an indentured servant, and this is what he writes to them. I'm only going to read you a bit of it. "This is to let you understand that I, your child, am in a most heavy case by reason of the nature of the country is such that it causeth much sickness, as the scurvy and the bloody flux, and diverse other diseases, which makes the body very poor and weak. And when we are sick, there is nothing to comfort us. For since I came out of the ship, I never ate anything but peas and loblolly, which is a type of water gruel. As for deer or venison, I never saw any since I came into this land. There is indeed some fowl, but we are not allowed to go and get it, but must work hard, both early and late, for a mess of water gruel, and a mouthful of bread and beef. A mouthful of bread for a penny loaf must serve for four men, which is most pitiful if you did know as much as I, when people cry out day and night, oh, that they were in England. I am not half a quarter so strong as I was in England, and all is for want of victuals, for I do protest unto you that I have eaten more in a day at home than allowed me here for a week. You have given more than my day's allowance to a beggar at the door. If you can't get the merchants to redeem me for some little money, then for God's sake, get a gathering or entreat some good folks to lay out some little sum of money in meal or cheese and butter and beef. Any eating meat will yield great profit. Oil and vinegar is very good." So, reading his letter, you get the sense that life in Jamestown, in early Jamestown in the 1620s, is really miserable. He is starvingly hungry, he's working, you know, his fingers to the bone, and he's in a society where there's almost no prospect, there's no hope for him. And he's the sort of person who you can see getting into that mentality, that mindset of giving up. You know, what's the point? I'm going to die anyway, I might as well, you know, just sort of not bother. So, early death definitely has a psychological impact. The fear of early death. But also it has a lot of practical consequences. You get, for instance, a complete lack of authority, because I talked about how many children were orphaned. Well, the lack of children, the lack of parents mean, you know, children don't have the same authority figures in their lives as they perhaps ought to. And you only need to look at modern day society where single-parent households are blamed for so many society's ills because of the lack of authority and discipline of a two-parent household. Well, you've got the same, but in spades, I think, in Virginia. You've also got a lack of experience, because the people who are experienced keep on dying. And so what happens is that they keep on making the same mistakes. Instead of people learning from their mistakes, or having somebody around to counsel wisdom, to say, oh, well, actually, the best way of doing this is like this. People are constantly having to sort of reinvent the wheel, having to reinvent things and relearn techniques because nobody knows how to do stuff. On the flip side, you do get an increased community responsibility for orphans. And some historians have argued that this is shows the strength of communities in English society. You also get, what I talked to some of the seminar groups about, is this power of widows. The fact that women, because they're so scarce, could marry several different men. And with each husband put together, and when I say marry several different men, I don't mean marry them at the same time, because that's called bigamy, but marry them sequentially as they all die off. And then women could, in a way, gather together significant amounts of property in one person. It doesn't really happen the other way around, because there are so many men and so few women. The very high infant mortality rates mean that you've got a very high reliance on immigration. You've got to have more people coming from England all the time, because even though there are women and they are having children, there aren't enough children anywhere near begin to maintain the size of the population.
And so the other thing, I guess it's another psychological factor, is that you get a culture of hedonism. This is the attitude whereby if you're going to die, you might as well enjoy yourself while you've got your time. You know, if you're going to die when you're 35 of malaria, then while you're young and you're healthy, you might as well, you know, have a few beers and go out and do something fun. It's sort of the student attitude to life, seems to me. And of course, students aren't the most socially responsible people most of the time. We don't trust them to run the country, for instance. And it's difficult to get a more stable society when you've got everybody looking out for a good time, really, because nobody's looking for the future. Nobody's thinking of investments or anything like that. One bonus, though, of early death, you know, it's like a silver lining to the clown, is you've got social mobility, because nobody occupies their position for very long. And you can get people in positions of power and authority, but if you're thinking, oh, well, I basically want to have a bit more authority, a bit more power myself, you only have to wait 6 months, and most of those people will be dead. So as long as you live, then, you know, you can move through the ranks pretty easily. It's a fairly socially fluid society. You know, even indentured servants, who, by the rights of their indenture, earn the right to own land, it's called the head right system, merely by living long enough to see your freedom, earns you 50 acres of land. Well, you could then, because of the early death, you know, the possibility exists for you to gain some kind of official position, perhaps become a JP, serve in the colonial assembly, and Russell Menard has written an article about this, it's on the media, looking at the different outcomes that servants could have, and he traces at least one servant who followed exactly that path, got land, got positions of power, ended up serving on the colonial council, which is like, you know, advising the governor as a former indentured servant. I mean, of course, not everyone did that, and some, you know, didn't live long enough to see out their indenture, and others never really owned that much land or lived a very meagre existence, but it's certainly possible to go from being an indentured servant to being a landed gentry in Virginia. And remember, this isn't possible in England. That's the big advantage of being in Virginia, is that you've got less possibility. One of the problems with the headright system is that it's great if you do live long enough and you get your 50 acres. The problem is you have to go and mark out and find your 50 acres. And usually that involves you travelling to where the Indians live and taking 50 acres off them and marking out with stakes. And of course, this inevitably causes conflict with Indians, who don't really like white people turning up in the middle of their tribal lands and marking out 50 acres for themselves. And so, frontiersmen marking out territories is invariably the cause of reprisals and violence against whites by Indians. I think in the last lecture on Virginia, I talked about the revocation of the Charter of the Virginia Company in 1624, partly occasioned by the Powhatan Massacre of 1622. The House of Burgesses, remember the first elected assembly in North America, remains, even though the charter has gone. It is a new council and a governor who are now royally appointed. So again, it's different from Maryland, as I said earlier. And you get increasingly a sense that the House of Burgesses is seeing itself, anyway, as a sort of mini House of Commons. It begins to assume a lot of those roles in the early 1640s, I think, or maybe slightly later. It gains control over finances. It's the body that votes taxes to the governor. And so the governor can't do very much without the consent of the House of Burgesses. And then in the 1650s, it gains control of the militia. Which means that if it's doing things that the governor doesn't like, the governor can't use the militia against it. You also see a relatively peaceful movement from a Commonwealth rule, from royal rule to Commonwealth rule, as in Cromwellian rule, in the 1650s, and then back again to royal rule in 1660. There's not a big civil war in Virginia over that change. Government has changed in England, Virginia swears loyalty eventually. It doesn't do so desperately willingly, and not until a few years after the death of Charles I, but eventually it does, and then it goes back to being loyal to Charles II when that happens in England. So, and by the end of the 17th century, and this is a really crucial point, the House of Burgesses can even initiate legislation. And one thing the House of Commons had always tried to secure for itself in England is the right to start legislation. Otherwise, it's just the King proposing legislation and the Commons either votes for it or doesn't. Whereas if you can initiate your own legislation, you get to set your own agenda very much more. And by the end of the 17th century, the House of Burgesses in Virginia has taken on that role, much like its counterpart in England. The council, the colonial council, although appointed by the governor, does act a bit like a House of Lords. And so it's got a tripartite structure of governor, council and House of Burgesses, much like you've got the King and the Lords and the Commons back home. And both the council and the House of Burgesses do see a fairly rapid turnover in membership, mainly because of high death rates. So. Here is William Berkeley. He is governor of Virginia for longer than anyone else. For 10 years before the Cromwellian takeover of Virginia in 1652, and then for a further 16 years after the Civil War and the Restoration in 1660. And he's eventually ousted during Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, which is the subject of a later lecture, I think in week 10. Tobacco remains the crop in Virginia, certainly the most important cash crop. What you've got in the early period, from like 1612, 1615, up through to about 1621, is a massive rise in the price of tobacco, which encourages a frenzy of planting and basically an oversupply. And eventually the price crashes but stabilises in the mid-1620s, meaning it's not so profitable to plant tobacco. It's still profitable, just not quite so profitable. And therefore, you need to stay in Virginia for longer to make the same amount of money. So price stabilisation does encourage longer-term investment rather than short-term investment. And to help grow tobacco, you get the first appearance of Africans in Virginia in 1619. The first reference we have to Africans is in the diary of John Rolfe, the man who married Pocahontas, remember? The man who introduced tobacco into Virginia in 1612, when he commented, around the last of August 1619, a Dutch man of war came in and sold us 20 ligars. And he's very sort of matter of fact about it. He doesn't talk about them being slaves, just Negroes. And their initial status of these Africans is very unclear. But the Africans in Virginia from 1619 is certain. Some of them would have been slaves, some of them would have been indentured servants, some won their freedom after a short period of time. Others certainly never did. So slavery is not a full-blown system until towards the end of the 17th century. Really 1680 is when slavery takes off in Virginia. And even in mid-century, there's only probably a few hundred Africans in Virginia compared to several thousand Englishmen. But it's the origins of American slavery in 17th century Virginia. And illustrated here by this marketing stamp for Virginian tobacco, Hyatt's Fine Mild Old Virginia, Russell Street, Covent Garden, and illustrated by Africans growing the tobacco plant, which looks a bit like that, and then they dry the leaves and then they pack it into these barrels and ship it to England. Hogsheads, they're called. As Virginia develops economically and politically, there are signs that Virginia is becoming more stable than it had been before. The problem is that how do you define what stability is? And how do you judge whether Virginia is becoming more stable or less stable? The old historiographic consensus, people like Bailyn and Edmund Morgan, always talked about life in the Chesapeake being nasty, brutish and short, and they were pretty much accurate in that assessment. But John Kukler argues in an article in the American Historical Review in 1985, which I think is called Order and Chaos in pre-Restoration Virginia or something like that. He says he thinks Virginia was actually a lot more stable than they make out, in that he talks about, you know, for example, the end of the Powhatan's of serious threat in Virginia. The maintenance of civil government, there's no restoration, for example, of martial law, which had been in existence in Virginia in 1611 to 1618. And the first appearance of brick houses, hence my picture of a brick house in Williamsburg, which historians take as a sign of permanency, because bricks are expensive, but you only build in brick if you are intending to use that house for a long period of time. Otherwise you build in wood, because wood is plentiful in Virginia, whereas brick is imported. Kukla posits these sorts of ideas for characterising stability. Low levels of collective violence, an absence of division, an acceptance of governmental authority, few changes of leadership, and when you have changes, they occur orderly. Now, a lot of those, you can tick those boxes for early Virginia, can't you? Because, for example, you get a few changes of leadership. William Berkeley, governor of Virginia for a long time. When you get changes, they occur without civil war. Look at the swap between the government of the Commonwealth and the Royal Government. So you know, he's certainly got a point, and Virginia is moving towards this. And a guy called Stephen Diamond in 1958, in an article in the American Sociological Review, talks about factors of stability in early Virginia. Why, if Kukla is right in saying, well, Virginia is more stable in the 1650s by 1660 than it had been in the 1630s and 40s, you know, why does that happen? Well, he lists these 6 points which he thinks explains it, including religion, because you've got Anglicanism becoming a lot more established. You know, religion up until then had been a lot less important. You get greater social stratification in Virginia, the development of a gentry class. The role the Assembly played in easing social tensions, basically a democratic point, that when communities can give voice to their concerns and fears democratically, then they don't resort to violence. The end of the headright system, which he thinks are a factor of stability, because they decrease Virginia's reliance on migrants for their population. Of course, the increased number of women, and finally, you know, the use of tobacco, which he sees as a really important development in early Virginia. Without tobacco, you wouldn't have Virginia, and I think he's right in that sense. And here is an example of a sign of permanency. One of the earliest houses in colonial America, Bacon's Castle, called Bacon's Castle, for other reasons, but Bacon's Castle in Virginia, built around 1660. You can see its age by looking at its chimneys. It's a classic sort of Tudor Stuart chimneys, always set at a slight angle to the house. They don't build them, you know, they will set them off 90 degrees. And it wouldn't look out of place in Oxfordshire, would it, or Wiltshire, or something like that. Some classic English country style house. But it's very expensive to build, because all this brick would have been imported. And this rather blurry map shows you how settlements had moved beyond just the river frontages and had gone way upstream, you know, as far as the falls of the James River, where Powhatan had originally settled. It had linked up to Maryland in the north, it spread south as well. So you've got a settlement that is increasingly dominating its region. It's got the population, it's got the economic raison d'etre, etc., to fill in those spaces. So I think Kukla is right. I don't think you can say that Virginia is less stable in 1660 than it had been in 1624. I think it's certainly more stable. And you've gone from a situation where Virginia was, you know, really clinging on to one where Virginia is thriving in 1660. You know, it's got its economic raison d'etre, it's got a stable political structure,
Its Indian problem has mainly disappeared. You know, it is carving out plantations, it is growing tobacco, shipping that tobacco back to London, making money. You know, these are all things which are improving in Virginia. And even its demographic problems are gradually solving themselves. I thought I'd read you this, maybe that. It appeared in the William Ray Portal. It's an advert from a spoof advert. It's called Jamestown States. As it's written as it by a real estate agent. And this is what it says. From the moment the gentle southern breezes waft your pinnace to the verdant garden-like shore, you'll know this is where you belong. Jamestown Estates, where only a few are living a life those in England can hardly imagine. Jamestown Estates, another proud project of the Virginia Company, combines the best in colonial living with the excitement, adventure, and opportunity for which the Virginia Company is famous. At Jamestown Estates, your every need is provided for in an environment that shows how caring people can live in symbiotic dominance of nature. And only Jamestown Estates offers an exclusive low-cholesterol meal plan, the SureFit exercise program, and a unique Friends Together living arrangement. In all details, Jamestown Estates is designed with your peace and well-being in mind. Each of our charming thatched roof cottages, which you will share with congenial, adventuresome people just like yourselves, especially designed to maximise both privacy and interpersonal contact, has a spectacular river view. At Jamestown Estates, nature itself invites you to relax, reflect, converse with newfound friends, and share stories of your new world experiences, while becoming the sort of person you've always wanted to be. But it's not all play at Jamestown Estates, not by a long shot, for Jamestown Estates offers one of the most active labour markets in the new world. Whatever you do, you can do it better here. Our employment office has many people anxious to welcome you to our growing workforce. No single advertisement can tell you all the remarkable things you'll want to know about Jamestown Estates. Consider, however, some of these exceptionally valuable Jamestown pluses. 24-hour security, palisaded grounds, hunting, fishing, right on the premises, native guides to teach you to hunt like a lord. The Sotweed Garden Centre, learn how to plant like a pro, no experience necessary. Regularly scheduled trash for treasure excursions to the nearby Pamunkey Flea Market, come and meet the chief. And as a special bonus to those who visit Jamestown Estates soon, we are introducing a new program called the Headlight System, your chance to receive 50 acres of land just for bringing yourself, or someone you know, to experience this new world of opportunity. Come in with a group, ask about our particular plantations program, build your private world right here in our new one. Finally, for those who appreciate the phenomenal profit potential of New World investment, there is the chance to secure shares in the Virginia Company itself, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, starting at just £10, 12 shillings and sixpence. To find out more, contact your nearest, friendly, knowledgeable Virginia Company representative. That made me laugh. Certainly, stories do sometimes have a security.